West Haven Elmhurst Community Recreation Association will be celebrating 50 years of serving the local NDG area.
Come and join us for our 50th anniversary at Coffee Park on August 20th.
Bring kids and the whole family. Games, music, food, and fun. Animated activities plus basketball tournament on our new court.
Prizes to be won. Live DJs and performers. Special edition t-shirts for sale. And refreshments will be available for purchase.
Also learn about West Haven's programming, including after school, teen drop-in, basketball, DJ and studio recording, dance, skills, yoga, and more. Call 514-872-6134 for more info.
Please come and join us.
West Haven's 50th anniversary in the park.
Saturday, August 20th from 1 to 8 p.m. Coffee Street between Elmhurst and West Broadway.
Happy birthday, West Haven!
Follow West Haven on Instagram and Facebook for more information.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
كل يوم جيت انا رص رص انا دوشه انا دوشه دوشه انا هص هص انا كل انا جيت في بيت انا رص رص انا دوشه انا دوشه دوشه انا هص هص انا كل انا كل كل انا نص نص انا عو عو انا يما يما انا حق انا حق حق انا خم خم انا اعمى انا اعمى اعمى انا بص بص انا عندي عندي هناك هناك انا جرح انا جرح جرح علاج علاج انا عيش انا عيش عيشه وعيش عيشه هلاك
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. Last Friday, August 5th, 2022, the Israeli military launched airstrikes across the Gaza Strip. In response, hundreds of rockets were fired from Gaza by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Group. Most of these were intercepted by Israel's air defense systems. The few that managed to make it through caused relatively minor damage to a few cars and buildings. In contrast, 48 Palestinians died from the 3 days of Israeli air bombardment. This included 17 children. One of the first Palestinians to be killed was only 5 years old. In this episode, our Palestine news team joins the podcast to talk about what led to the violence this past week, its impact on Palestinian and Israeli politics, and what Palestinians in Gaza lived through over the past week. This is the first time the entire Palestine News Bureau has been together on the podcast. Yumna Patel is our Palestine News Director based in Bethlehem. Mariam Barghouti is our Senior Palestine Correspondent based in Ramallah. Tariq Hajjaj is our Gaza Correspondent in Gaza City. And Ferris Jackman is our managing editor, also in Ramallah. Thanks, everyone, for joining me on the podcast. It's been a busy week for all of you, and we're glad that you've all remained safe through these recent events. Yumna, I want to begin with you. The Israeli military targeted members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Group, or PIJ. What is Palestinian Islamic Jihad? What are their origins?
Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or PIJ, as you said, started, you know, like all other major Palestinian political factions, as a resistance group. That was how it was birthed, as a resistance to the Israeli occupation and Israeli colonialism in Palestine. It was founded in the early 1980s, and it had origins in the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, though it eventually became its own movement and organization, starting in Gaza. It was founded with the goal of establishing a Palestinian state across the occupied Palestinian territory and parts of historic Palestine. In the present day, unlike Hamas and other factions, the group has placed little emphasis on its political ambitions and has focused more of its efforts and resources into its military wing, which is the Al-Quds Brigades. So while it's not as large as Hamas in size or even military power, the armed wing of PIJ has participated in all the confrontations with Israel out of Gaza. And in the latest escalation, they were the only group to respond to the Israeli offensive, while Hamas sort of sat on the sidelines. And the group also has a significant presence in the occupied West Bank, primarily in Jenin, in the northern West Bank, where many of the group's confrontations with the army, with the Israeli army, have taken place since the beginning of this year.
And how do they fit into the broader landscape of armed resistance groups, particularly in Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, you know, Hamas is definitely the larger power, both politically and militarily, in Gaza. But PIJ definitely maintains a strong presence, and a presence that has, as I believe we've seen, grown increasingly stronger in the past few years. I mean, they played a large role in the Israeli offensive and the Palestinian resistance to the Israeli offensive last year in 2021 out of Gaza, which, as we know, lasted for 11 days. And they were the sole group in Gaza that confronted the Israeli army this go around. And so they've been gaining traction, particularly in the West Bank, I would say, over the past few months, as its fighters have continued to engage and confront the Israeli forces, particularly, as I mentioned, in Jenin. And so PIJ, in the past few years, and particularly in the past few months, has definitely been coming closer to the forefront as it's established itself purely as a military resistance group, whereas Hamas, it had similar origins over the past 10, 15 years, has definitely positioned itself, along with its military wing, has placed a lot of emphasis as well on its political ambitions, and has become more of an authoritative figure, of course, as it's continued to rule over the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm.
Mariam, can you walk us through the timeline of events that led up to this last week's violence?
Of course, in terms of any Palestinian timeline, you want to go back to 1948, but in the recent changes and development, and especially in the West Bank and what we've seen in Gaza, it didn't start with the assault of Operation Breaking Dawn this August. What happened was earlier this year, around, you know, March, April, Israel officially started speaking about its Operation Break the Wave, which is a series of operations across historic Palestine with the Shin Bet and Israeli military to target Palestinian resistance. And this is not just armed resistance. This includes any form of Palestinian resistance, including cultural sector, including unarmed protests, including increased demolitions, especially in vulnerable areas like we've seen in the Jordan Valley. And it persisted in that. So on February 8th, you saw Israeli special units raiding Nablus, for example, and riddling a car with live ammunition, killing three Palestinians, Ashraf Mubasalat, Adham Mabruke, and Mohammed Dakhil. And these were later only recently kind of identified as comrades of Ibrahim al-Nablusi, who was assassinated on 9th of August of this year as well. And he's known as the Lion of Nablus. He wasn't 19 years old yet. And this is all part of the Israeli also elections, right? You know, since 2019, Israel is entering its fifth national vote after dispersing the parliament. So you're seeing how Palestinians are being weaponized across Israeli internal political spheres and sectors, you know, and what they're using is things like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad right now as kind of concealment of what is really happening. And that is the Israeli internal strife and divisions are resulting in an escalation and intensification of assaults on Palestinians. And this is important because constantly people say, what about Palestinian divisions between Hamas and Fatah? But nobody really asks about this, you know, the division within Israeli politics that Palestinians mm-hmm. end up paying the price for.
Tariq, I want to bring you in. On the day that the recent airstrikes began, you shared some photos with our staff along with the message, quote, the airstrike was only 70 meters away from my home. Can you tell us what you experienced living through this recent cycle of Israeli attacks on Gaza?
It is hard to imagine that it is only a matter of time between you going back home safe and sound or being killed or injured while naturally walking on the street. The day that the airstrike started, it started in my neighborhood, as it always does. The first airstrike was at the stairs of Abu Sambra Mosque. I went there immediately after helping calls coming from the speaker. The place was crowded with people, and they came to help. Before the ambulance arrived, local people moved the injured by their cars, and the airstrike killed two people, including the 5-year-old girl, Ala Kadum. I saw the blood over the mosque stairs. Shrapnel left holes in the surrounding medical and stone doors and walls. And women were coming out of their homes to check on their children who were playing around the street. Now, you can imagine that 10 of my family members, including me, had our Friday prayers at that mosque. And if the airstrike had started 2 hours earlier, I would have some of my family, maybe me, killed or injured. This is what it feels like under Israeli attack. Everyone, alongside with his family, becomes obsessed of surviving because they see with their bare eyes how the Israeli airstrikes are scary and terrifying, and they do not want to see their beloved ones suffering. Speaking about suffering, which is the only output of the Israeli attacks on Gaza, now after the war, the suffering starts to show up. Today, 11-year-old girl Lina Ashar passed away due to her wounds from an Israeli airstrike in Khan Yunis. 2 days ago, another 10-year-old Hanin Abu Qaida passed away as well. I mean, I'm still writing stories of death and loss and destruction from the May 21 war on Gaza. And now 50 people were killed and over 400 injured after only one year of terrifying 11 days of bomb. Why? I'm trying to find some answers here, but I think this is the way Israel wants to Palestinians to live. And they are, as we see, able to plant sadness in everybody's heart in Gaza.
Talk to us about what you experienced as you went through. That was on Friday. Tell us about your full experience over those several days of bombardment.
I was following the news. Every bomb just I heard, I went to look where it was and who were killed in this airstrike and bomb. They were very scary and tired days I lived, but we were working to document every single event that happened in these 3 days.
Faris, the government in Gaza is controlled by Hamas. The government in the West Bank is controlled by the Fatah-dominated Palestinian National Authority, which was created during the Oslo Accords in the early 1990s. This latest confrontation, as we've heard, was largely between Israel and the PIJ. did not engage in any of the fighting. Can you explain to us how armed confrontation with Israel has evolved in recent years and why Hamas was absent in this round?
I first want to provide a brief background on what actually led us here. And I want to do that by talking about how Palestinian confrontation with Zionism has evolved over the past two decades. This basically takes us back to the Second Intifada of the early 2000s, which was a full-scale military confrontation between armed Palestinian factions and the Israeli military. The Intifada lasted for roughly 5 years, and it was notable for inflicting considerable casualties in Israeli ranks, and more than ever before in the history of Palestinian armed struggle. So despite the power imbalance and the heavy toll paid by Palestinians, the armed resistance still posed a formidable military challenge to what was regarded as the most powerful army in the Middle East. And even in the early years of the uprising, Martin Van Creveld, who was one of the most important Zionist military historians, he was basically saying, quote unquote, we're losing. So Israel's response to this was to mount a massive counterinsurgency campaign. And it began as a series of military operations against the bastions of armed resistance, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. And the objective of that operation, the most notable being Operation Defensive Shield in 2002, was to root out Palestinian guerrilla groups, and more importantly, to separate them from their social base. And what's notable about this period is that Fatah and the Palestinian Authority were a significant part of the armed struggle. But this wasn't really to be so for very long, because the Israeli counterinsurgency campaign largely succeeded. But it's important to note that its success was partial. It reached a permanent ceasefire with Fatah and the PA in 2005. And then the next phase in its counterinsurgency began, what you might call soft counterinsurgency. And that was basically to pacify and defang Fatah and the PA. We know this period as Salam Fayyad and Netanyahu's economic peace plan, or some people know it as the period in which U.S. General Keith Dayton launched an effort to create what is called a new Palestinian. And this basically refers to the massive resources that were put into restructuring the Palestinian police force and to reorganize the PA security apparatus. And the objective of that was to create a generation of, you know, obedient soldiers disconnected from their social environments. Alongside all of that, Palestinian consumerism also skyrocketed. You had entire generations who became saddled with debts and bank loans, and all of this was basically exclusively happening in the West Bank. Now, the other side of the coin of this is Gaza. And Gaza is what I was really talking about when I said that the Israeli counterinsurgency was partially successful, because it wasn't really in Gaza. Hamas and the Islamic Jihad never gave in to the pressures that Fatah buckled under in 2005. And for a number of reasons, the factions within Hamas that supported the continuation of armed resistance were dominant, and they remained dominant within Hamas. Whereas in Fatah, the militants were marginalized, their arms were confiscated, and they were basically relegated to the sidelines. We'll get back to them in a bit, but let's stay on Gaza for a few seconds. So obviously, with the West Bank effectively pacified for the time being, Israel's counterinsurgency shifted towards Gaza. And that strategy was the blockade, which started about 15 years ago. And the objective of it was to basically starve out the Palestinian population and to levy a high price for continuing to resist. And with the express hope that this would be enough to turn the population against the resistance, to create resentment against Hamas. And now, of course, Hamas as a ruling party was repressive and left much to be desired in terms of governance, corruption, cronyism, et cetera, and especially being in an already starved and besieged strip. But alongside all of that, it still managed to hold on to its seat in Gaza, and it managed to maintain a resistance line against Israel. Now, the Islamic Jihad is a little bit different. The Islamic Jihad never wanted to engage in politics. They weren't interested in the business of ruling. So their sole commitment has and continues to be armed resistance against Zionism in Palestine. Now, that being said, Hamas-Jihad relations, as Yumna mentioned, have been relatively close throughout the blockade. And in previous wars on Gaza, they participated in joint military operations against Israel. So to return to the main thrust of your question, this recent war was different. Hamas didn't engage in battle, and the Islamic Jihad was left to fight on its own. And the reason for that is that Hamas, as a ruling party, has been feeling the crushing weight of the blockade, which has lasted for more than 15 years. This year was not the year it was prepared to engage in another round of fighting with Israel, and it was still reeling from last year's war in May 2021. Now, this, I think, is the crux of the matter, which is that for the first time in the history of Gaza's wars, this war was not started in order to eradicate resistance in the Gaza Strip per se, but to eradicate it in the West Bank. Now, let me say that again. Israel launched this offensive in order to root out resistance in the West Bank. So let's get back now to the Fatah militants in the West Bank who were marginalized that I mentioned earlier. They were marginalized, it's true, but they weren't wiped out. And indeed, they've witnessed a resurgence. And Maryam might tell us more about this context. But what I'll say here is that the West Bank seems to be witnessing the emergence of more and more armed groups that are disaffected and unhappy with the status quo. And most of them are tied either to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is the military wing of Fatah, or are tied to or influenced by the Islamic Jihad, the main leadership of which is based in Gaza, obviously. And it appears that the Islamic Jihad has been putting efforts into creating more networks in the West Bank. And this is what explains Israel's so-called preemptive strike against the Jihad in Gaza. It wants to deal a blow to Jihad and to take out some of its main leaders because it wants to neutralize whatever role it may have in funding or agitating for or planning for armed resistance in the West Bank. So, you know, for the first time, you have the future of the West Bank being fought out in Gaza, as opposed to being fought out in the West Bank. Of course, it is also being fought out in the West Bank, as is evidenced by what Maryam called the Operation Breaking the Wave. Gaza is a thorn in Israel's side. There's no doubt about it, because it's effectively the last bastion of armed resistance in Palestine that also exercises a modicum of exclusive territorial control over a part of Palestine. But what Israel can't stomach is for something similar to happen in the West Bank. And that's what also explains the campaign of repression and assassinations and arrests that have been going on the West Bank in recent months. And of course, I'll leave Maryam to tell us more about
it. Maryam, that's a good setup. I'd like you to tell us more about what happened in Nablus less than 48 hours after the ceasefire was agreed to, when Israel was hunting some wanted resistance fighters. And if you can also expand on what Faris is talking about, because in the past week, you've made the point several times in different interviews and articles you've written that you see the West Bank as the next front for broader Israeli violence.
Thank you, Dave. And yeah, adding to what Faris was saying, so just 48 hours approximately after the ceasefire in Gaza, where one of the demands by the PIJ was that Israel ceases its targeted attacks against affiliates and members in the West Bank. So what happened was in the old city of Nablus, where there are, you know, reports that there are Palestinian armed resistance fighters kind of taking refuge there, as has historically happened in Palestine because of the increased surveillance and repression we've seen by the Israeli military. So they seek refuge kind of in these areas that have historically been mapped out to be safe spaces. But what we realized is that the Israeli military, in coordination, again, with its counter intelligence units, special forces, waited until the early hours of dawn and then raided the old city, Al-Faqus neighborhood within the old city, and targeted three Palestinians, one of whom is Ibrahim Nablusi, whom I mentioned earlier. Another is Hussein Taha, a 16-year-old Palestinian, and Islam Subah, who was 32. And Israel's allegations is that they were part of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. And this is Fatah's armed wing. So what we're seeing is that Israel just constantly tries to scapegoat various Palestinian factions. But in reality, what it is trying to do is quell any spirit of confrontation and defiance. And they bombed the homes in the Old City. And this is also destruction of artifacts and historical maps that the Israeli army consistently does. And then they fired bullets incessantly at Ibrahim Nablusi and reportedly also his comrade Islam Subuh, who was with him at the time in hiding. And the sheer amount of the destruction I saw the day after, it's they were there to shoot and kill or destroy and kill. And it's very similar to the extrajudicial assassination of February 8th, where also Nablusi's comrades were killed by, again, the military and the Shin Bet. But what we're seeing is, and Faris puts this very well, in that for the first time, for example, the fate of the West Bank was in Gaza. The other part of the story is that what we are seeing is a unification of Palestinians. So you're seeing these younger generations kind of foregoing the idea of what Fatah was, what Hamas was, what Islamic Jihad was. This is too ancient of a memory for them to have witnessed it. So they know it as secondhand testimonies. And what they're doing is, I think that there's a trend that is very visible amongst the historical stories of all these factions, armed or unarmed, in that they all initially started as a confrontation towards the Israeli brutal colonial military invasion that we experience on a daily basis. And, you know, the young age is telling of that as well, that every generation, as long as they are put under the brutality of Israeli colonialism, will respond back. But now it's kind of curbing the expected response. Palestinians are expected to just protest and keep getting killed in protests, or for our journalists to get assassinated when they're covering developments in Jenin, for example, as we saw with Shirin Abu Aqleh. And they're recognizing, no, I can fight back. And this is what we saw with Ibrahim Nablusi. He fought back. He said, I believe I will be martyred. I'm going towards martyrdom and not let go of the rifle. And what's that telling of is that this is not a life. Living under the Israeli rule of its military and settler expansion is not a life. And I think that's what's really happening, this coming together, which is also related to what we saw Palestinian armed resistance in Elid by Palestinians with Israeli citizenship. And it's this unification that's happening. They called it the Battle of the Unified Arena during the latest onslaught on Gaza.
Tariq, I want to go back to Gaza and what people experienced during this round of violence. You've been collecting stories from people across Gaza this week about what they experienced. Can you share a couple of stories maybe in particular that stand out to you?
I was interviewing a family and I finished my work and woke to leave. A man called me and he asked about any way that I can help his children who apparently suffer trauma. He told me that boy can't sleep at all. All the night he covers his head and screams. He took me to his home and I found there over 20 children living in the building. All of them have something remaining in their souls. The 3-year-old boy comes with his father and his eyes widely open. I got him close to me and let him play with the camera I was holding. And then he answered some questions with some words like fire, bomb, and death. Can you imagine what war left behind regarding this little boy who experiences these words at this age? 2 people from this boy's family were killed, including 10-year-old girl, and dozens were injured. And I think he witnessed them all. I met another man who was supposed to get married last Saturday, the second day of this attack. The day was scheduled months ago, but he decided to cancel all the formality related to the wedding day. Instead, he just went to bring his bride to his home. Israel targeted him while he was standing at his bride's home and killed his mistake. There are thousands of such stories on the ground after this attack, and Palestinians in Gaza will live in these conditions over and over again, unless
it's important to understand the political maneuvering and positioning that goes on, but everyday people on the ground that are the ones that suffer from these things. Yumna, back to you. Put all of this into the context of Israeli politics for us. Israeli elections are scheduled for November 1st. Yair Lapid is the current prime minister, and he's trailing in the polls with Benjamin Netanyahu, who is running for his old job. How does Operation Breaking Dawn fit into the political maneuvering in Israel?
So, I mean, almost immediately in the lead up even to Israel launching that first airstrike on Gaza over last weekend and throughout the operations, you know, analysts were saying that electoral influences were most certainly fueling Israel's decision to launch its offensive on Gaza and fire that first strike. It was openly treated amongst the current governing coalition as a preemptive attack to, quote, curb Palestinian, you know, quote unquote, terrorism. And as Faris mentioned, you know, it was a clear attempt to attack and stifle growing PIJ strongholds and activity in the West Bank. So while the operation was most certainly an attempt to flesh out and quash Palestinian resistance, a key part of understanding the timing of this whole thing is to understand what you mentioned, which is what's happening right now in Israeli politics. As Miriam mentioned earlier in the conversation, this fall, Israel will be entering its fifth national vote since 2019. And the current governing coalition, which is way behind in the polls, is seeking to look strong in the face of challengers like former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing Likud party, who are posed to make a very strong return into the Israeli political arena. And so Lapid, who's the current PM, comes from a center-left background. I use that term very loosely. And he's seeking to establish his standing, you know, as a strong man and a sort of hawkish figure and increase his popularity within Israeli society, which, as we know, has been steadily growing more and more right-wing in recent years. And it seems that, at least in the aftermath or the immediate aftermath of this operation in Gaza, is that Lapid and his governing coalition were somewhat successful in their goals. So according to Israeli media, new polls show that Lapid's approval rating in the Israeli public increased after Operation Breaking Dawn, bringing him closer to Netanyahu's approval ratings. Though Netanyahu's ratings are still far higher than Lapid and that of Defense Minister Benny Gantz. The polls also showed that 68% of respondents were satisfied with Lapid's handling of the operation, and even a higher number reported the same for Gantz. Additionally, and perhaps the most telling, the polls showed that if elections were held today, Netanyahu would fall short of a 61-seat majority in Israel's parliament. And that is compared to the same poll that was taken before the operation, which said that Netanyahu would win a majority of the seats if elections were held at that time prior to the operation. So we're already starting to see the effects within, you know, Israeli politics, the effects of this operation on Gaza. And as you mentioned, you know, at the end of the day, Gazans are being the ones that are, you know, forced to pay the price for Israeli politicians and their, you know, seeking their political gains when it comes to elections. And this is something that Palestinians and, you know, what journalists or analysts, whoever's familiar with Palestine, and particularly when it comes to Israeli policies in Gaza, are well aware of this policy. It's something we hear all the time. This quote unquote mowing the lawn, right, every few years. And this is not the first time that deadly Israeli military offensives just happen to coincide or, you know, come just a short time before Israeli elections. It's happened time and time again. It's a tried and true tactic used by Israeli politicians to boost their standing within society, to appear strong. within the Israeli public. And so that's what people are saying was, you know, one of also the main sort of drivers behind this most recent operation as well.
Are people there, whether Israeli or Palestinian, expecting more violence ahead of the elections?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are sort of waiting to see if this ceasefire will hold up. As Mariam talked about earlier, is that, you know, just in less than 48 hours after the ceasefire with Islamic Jihad in Gaza, Israel assassinated a number of Palestinian fighters in Nablus. And though those particular resistance fighters belonged to the armed wing of the Fatah movement, we've seen increasingly, as Mariam also mentioned, this sort of unity and increased collaboration as well between PIJ fighters and Fatah, or fighters with Fatah's armed wing, not only in, particularly in Jenin and Nablus. So I think people are sort of kind of holding their breath, waiting to see not only if this ceasefire will hold up, but what other measures Israel is going to take as part of this larger, you know, breaking the wave operation, whether it's against the resistance in the West Bank or in Gaza.
We didn't talk much about what Mahmoud Abbas and the PA have been doing for the last week. It seems like the political energy in the West Bank, from what I'm hearing from Mariam and Faris, is really around the positioning of Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The PA is just not coming up much in these conversations.
So the Palestinian Authority is, you know, ruled by the Fatah Party. So the continued rise also of resistance fighters affiliated with Al-Aqsa Brigade requires, you know, the PA and Fatah as a party to take that in, to embrace that and reclaim it or claim it as part of theirs, which also puts, you know, the Palestinian Authority in a corner as historically been a collaborator with the Israelis. I think also until now, the Palestinian Authority is likely collaborating with Israeli forces during these assassinations. But what we've seen from Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh were letters of condemnation, as well as Hussein al-Sheikh, who is the head of the civil administration here in Palestine, is condemnation letters against, you know, the continued assault of the Israeli military against Palestinians. But there are no real protection measures being taken in terms of, you know, supporting Palestinians, whether it's resistance fighters that are armed or Palestinians that are facing increased home demolitions or detainment by the Israeli military. At the same time, a lot of the, you know, armed resistance that we saw rise across the past perhaps year were also of Palestinians that were, you know, affiliated with the Palestinian Authority previously. If you keep in mind, the West Bank was demilitarized under Oslo Accords, especially during Operation Defensive Shield, when Faris mentioned it during the Second Intifada. So the amount of arms that are within the West Bank is also very limited.
What the PA has been doing is that it's been trying to toe the line between open security coordination with Israel and to hold on to some modicum of popularity with the Palestinian street. And what this has resulted in is that, as Mariam said, it leads to a string of condemnations, very stridently worded, but, you know, nothing more. So we're really in a situation where you have all of these people who are disaffected and kind of discontented with how the ruling factions within Fatah are operating. And what this has led to is the rise of a new generation that historically come from families with backgrounds affiliated to Fatah, including the martyr Ibrahim Nablusi and his comrades who are based in Nablus and who are affiliated with the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, even though they also had, it appears that they also had tied with the Islamic Jihad in terms of, you know, funding and arming. And similarly, of course, all of the crackdowns that have been happening in Jenin are also part of that story. Those who are continuing the resistance agenda within Fatah and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades are now starting to sort of come together and to come into their own more. Now, whether that would actually lead to something bigger or more developed, it's kind of hard to say at this point. And Israel is obviously expending massive efforts in order to kind of quell that, to quell that and prevent it from happening. And throughout all of this, the PA has basically been standing in the silence, kind of taking in the events, and sort of, you know, not knowing what to do. So this is how I view the situation.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider becoming a donor by visiting MondoWeiss.net/donate. MondoWeiss is a nonprofit publication, and every donation of any amount helps sustain our work. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and review to help other listeners find our show.
زهقت منك بقى واشوف لي اي طريق هشوف لي اي طريق مع اني طول الطريق ابلع تراب كري كان سم في البريد اضحك في عز الدين عيني طول تيمه الحب يا
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Wanna do my thing, go to the club till the early morning. Jump around like ain't nobody watching. I don't really care that my baby calling. I just wanna ease my pain. No, I blame nobody, nobody.
got your money. Don't say nothing sweet, cause I ain't your honey. You won't listen to me, not even in stereo. You want me to change, yeah, but I don't think so. Cause I ain't super fly, I don't even have to try. And I don't need nobody, baby, let me tell you why. I just wanna do my thing. Go to the club, to the...